This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
In verse 26, Pasuk Chavov, for a little longer, where it says, "Vayomer Elokim," and God said, "Na'aseh Odom b'tzalmeinu kidmuseinu." Let us make Odom in our form and in our image. And last week, you remember, we had two understandings of that that plural when God says, "Let us make." The one was the view that Rashi brought, that God consulted with his angels, and the other was that he was referring to the earth. Na'aseh, let us, let me, the source of spirituality, and you, the earth, the source of earthiness, create something that spans that full spectrum, from the ultimate of purity and spirituality to the ultimate of materialism. Let us create a being that actually contains both of that together. And that is the magnificence of the human being, the only creature, the only creation, including God himself, the only being that combines and synthesizes the ultimate of spirituality with the ultimate of matter, and brings them together in one being with all the conflicts and all the tensions that creates, and that's the essence of human life, as opposed to other life. And we're going to discuss that further in a moment. And taking that view then, we've got to interpret as well, that's the view of the Radak and the Ramban, taking that view further, we've got to say that when God says in the next phrase, "Betzalmeinu kidmuseinu," in our form and in our image, normally we talk about man created in the image of God, and that's quite right, man is created in the image of God. But if you look at the grammar correctly in that word, you'll see it's not only in the image of God, because that's in the plural as well. So when God says that we will create him in our image and in our form, what is the our? The our, so if you say that means that God was talking to the angels, then he means to create God in the form of the angels and in the image of the angels. That's the traditional interpretation. But if we use the Radak and the Ramban as we did last week, then Betzalmeinu kidmuseinu means in our form and image, you and me, earth and God. So we are created with a dual form. We are created in the image of God, that's true, but we're also created in the image of earthiness. That's why we have an animal appearance to us as well. There's a lot about us that looks like the animal. And in fact, the Midrash numbers four each. There are four things in which we're spirit, four areas in which we're spiritual, four areas in which we're physical. Boraboy, arbo brius milamalo, the arbo milamato. There are four essential human dimensions that are spiritual and four that are physical. Oichel v'shoyse kibahemo, we eat and drink like animals. Poro v'rove kibahemo, we reproduce like animals. Umeitel galolim kibahemo, we excrete like animals. Umeis kibahemo, and we die like animals. Those are the four activities that we share with the animal world. That doesn't mean we do it in the same way that animals do it. Obviously, we have that the spiritual element that we have permeates everything that we do, including our animal activities. But there are four areas in which we function biologically like any other animal. And milamalon, the four spiritual ones are oimed kemalochi hashores. We stand like angels. We have dignity. An animal doesn't have dignity. We stand on our two feet. We hold our head high. We're able to stand with dignity, and that's godly. Our posture is godly. And therefore that's something that should be studied, it's something that should be learnt, it's something that should be taught in yeshivas. And it used to be, you would get a Rosh Yeshiva call a boy and say, the way you're walking, the way you're standing, it's not dignified, it's not classy. And people used to be sent to movement classes to be able to understand how to use their bodies. That's all part of spirituality, of spiritual dignity. The way we move, we have the capacity to move in a way that animals can't. Animals can move in very beautiful ways, but that's instinctive. Each animal has its particular way of moving, and it's tied to that. It can't change that. But the human being can choose how he wants to move. He can use his body as a gesture, as a form of communication. Every limb, that he can move, every movement that he makes is a gesture, it's a communication. And that's part of spirituality. The ability of the human being to use his body to communicate dignity, that's something that only the human being can do. That's spirituality. Medaber kemalachei hashores, We can speak like angels can. That's a godly function. No animal can communicate the way we can. They can communicate in the sense of being able to send messages to one another, but that's not the essence of communication. Communication is to be able to impact on the feelings and emotions of another. Not just to send information to another. One can send information to one another by email, but you can't impact on the feelings of another person. For that you need communication. And what constitutes communication? It's the totality of human communication. It's using the voice, using the gestures, using the face, using expressions, using everything that language, correct usage of language, using modulation, using everything that is at the disposal of the human being for the purpose of communication. And it's interesting how we are allowing electronic communication to be used, and it is so limited, it's so unbelievably limited, apart from all the tests that have been done on telephonic communication, how much misunderstanding there is when people communicate by telephone, and how much more so when they communicate by other forms of electronic communication. It was an interesting comment by Rabbi Finkelstein that a lot of people listen to Rabbi Miller's tapes. You heard about Rabbi Miller's tapes. People listen to Rabbi Miller's tapes and they get to know him from his tapes. And when he went to New York, I said, go to a shiur of Rabbi Miller's. So he came back and I said, did you go? He said, yes. I said, and? He said, he's a different human being. The shiur is different. I said, why? What's different? He says, he sometimes says very extreme sort of things. And you listen on the tape and you have this picture of him as a mean, extreme, dogmatic human being. But when he's talking and he says these things, he's laughing. He's got smiles on his face. He's laughing at it. So you see him as a completely different human being. And you see what he means. To listen to those things without seeing him is totally dangerous. And so it is with any shiur. To listen to a tape, unless it's just information communication, and it's not really communicating, one loses a fortune if there isn't a face-to-face communication with an individual. If you can't see the expression on his face, the twinkle in his eyes, the smile on his mouth, as he's saying something, you don't know quite how to take it. Is he being serious? Is he being sarcastic? One doesn't know what to do. One doesn't know how to take it and how to handle it. That was why for years I never allowed the tapes to be circulated. Now I figured it doesn't make all that much difference. People are there, they're not there. People who understand will understand. People who don't understand don't even understand if they're sitting there. So it makes no difference. So that's communication, which is godly. It's our stature, our communication. Yesh bodas kemalachei ha'shores. We have an intellect. That's godly. V'roye kemalachei ha'shores. And the fourth one, interestingly, is sight. We can see like angels. That's a peculiar one. Ask the Medrash. Uvehemo eino roye etzmo. Don't be ridiculous. Animals can see too. Answers the Gemara, eloze mitzadeid. But we have wide vision. We can see breadth. And that impacts on the way we think. That's on the way, that impacts on the way we vision. It impacts on the way we imagine. It impacts on the way we dream. It impacts on the way we reason. Our ability to see in a broad fashion. Now, of course, it doesn't always work like that. Sometimes you find human beings who don't stand like angels. They slink around like animals. And sometimes you find human beings that don't speak like angels. They communicate in a gruff, unschooled, unsophisticated way like animals. Sometimes you find human beings that don't think like human beings. They don't think in a godly fashion. They don't think with depth and with agility. They think in a very superficial and dogmatic sort of way. And sometimes you've got human beings who don't see with broad vision. The breadth of vision, that's the godly feature that we have. The ability to see breadth, the ability to see wide perspective, the ability to scan a whole picture and to see and to understand the interconnection between what we see. It's not just that we can physically include a wide angle in our vision. It's that we can take a scan and we can understand how everything fits in. The animal can't. He just sees what's in front of him. And if he turns his head and he looks to the side, it's a different frame. He just sees different things. He doesn't understand the connection between them. Like when I was studying in England, I remember for months and months, I used to get one from one place in London to another place in London. I used to change tube trains 3 times because they were on different places, different pages of the map, until I realized that they were just across the road from each other. It's just that the map was divided there, so I never connected them up. And it's like that with some people's vision. They look at things in such separate segments that they're unable to see the commonality, they're unable to see how things interlink with one another and interact with one another. And that's a flaw in their godliness. A person who doesn't stand with dignity and move with dignity, a person who doesn't communicate with dignity, a person who doesn't reason with depth, and a person who doesn't see with breadth, is a human being who is not utilizing his godliness. And we'll see in a moment what the consequences of that is. And that's what it means when God says, we shall make man in our image, earth and God, animal and angel will be combined. Four elements of the animal, four elements of the angel will be combined into one being called the human being, called Adam. Now interestingly, why is he called Adam? That comes from the word Adomo, from earth. So obviously, as the Torah itself says later on, he's called Adam because he's taken from earth. And the Radak asks, why differentiate? Then he's not that doesn't differentiate him from the animals. The animals are also taken from the earth. Where are animals formed from? And you remember last week we learned that the origin of man, the Medrash says, that the origin of Adam's body and being was when God said, let there be animals. So in a sense, our physical, as we learned in the Ramban last week, our physical bodies, our beings, develop from the animal world. There's no question about that. Up till a certain point. In that case, by calling us Adam, you're not differentiating us from the animal world. The animal world also is Adam. So why call us Adam? In what way does that make us different from the apes, from the monkeys? They're also Adams. They also come from Adomo. They're also produced by the land. For the cows and the sheep and they're all produced by the land. So if our name is meant to differentiate us, why use the word Adam, which is in fact what we're all made from? Answers the Radak, no, it's to differentiate us from angels. It's true we're not differentiated from the animals in that sense because they're all from the animal, they're all made from the earth. But the angels have nothing of the earth in them. They're purely spiritual. And God wants to differentiate us from the angel. Now what does that mean? That means, this is quite an amazing concept, that means that we need differentiation from the angel more than we do from the animal. It's easier to mistake us for an angel than it is to mistake us for an animal. That's what it means. Darwin mistook us for animals because he never saw an angel. But if Darwin would have seen angels, he would have worked a whole theory of evolution of how we evolved from angels, because he would have thought we looked much more like angels than we do like animals. And in fact, that's what the angels thought. A beautiful, beautiful Medrash. And the Medrash says, it's a Medrash one should never forget. Omar Rabbi Hoshaya b'sho'o she'boro HaKadosh Baruch Hu Adam HaRishon. When God completed the creation of Adam, and he was a complete human being, not just his animal form, but his complete humanity was there. Tohu boi maloche hashoris uvikshu loyma lefonov kodosh. The angels made a mistake, and when they saw Adam, they started saying, kodosh, kodosh, kodosh. They thought it was God. That's what a human being is. That when the angels first saw man, they thought they were looking at God. That's how great the human being is capable of being. And God, so to say, caught a fright at their mistake. And says, and God put Adam to sleep. That was the first time that Adam fell asleep. When they saw Adam sleeping, they realized he wasn't God. That was it. That's how they realized. But man, when he's alive, is a God. And just take that medrash to its true meaning. Man, when he's asleep, is a nothing. Man, when he's alive, is God. That's how great he can be. So why do most of us not think that we're standing in front of God when we stand in front of each other? Because most of us are asleep most of the time, and there's no way of mistaking us for God when we're asleep. And even though we walk around and we actually act as if we're sort of alive, we're not. And you can see that by how much we miss, how much we don't notice, how we fail to respond. We're three quarters asleep. Sleeping is not a state you're either asleep or you're awake. There's a whole spectrum between being awake and being asleep. And you know that as you get up in the morning, sort of you drift into being awake, and as you fall asleep at night, you fall asleep slowly and you get into that state of consciousness. Well, it could continue. You see, what happens is people, they're asleep, then their alarm clock rings and they start waking up, and then they get up when they're still three quarters asleep, and they remain in that state of being three quarters asleep until they get back to bed at night, and then they go fully. So we oscillate between being fully asleep and three quarters asleep. That's the kind of level that we oscillate between. When you see a person who's alert, occasionally you come across a person who's awake. And then you see what a human being is. Then you see what it is to be alert. Then you see what it is to be awake and what it is to be alive. And when you see that truly to the ultimate sense of a great human being who's really alive, there an angel would mistake that for God himself. That's the capacity of the human being. That's how great he can be if he chooses. He can get to that level where an angel would look at him and say, goodness, this is God. So Hashem gives us the name Adam to differentiate us from angels, because it's easier to mistake us for angels than it is to mistake us for animals. And it's so tragic that today it's not that way. But today when scientists look at us, they see animals. When psychologists look at us, they see animals. When sociologists look at us, they see animals. They see a sophisticated animal. Why? Because that godly part of us is so far removed, we're so fast asleep, that the godly part of us hardly shines. And we can hardly blame people for seeing us as animals. As I said to you last week, the issue of evolution is not an issue of a question of thousands or millions of years ago, however you want to understand it, whether we were created from apes or we weren't. The issue is, what are we today? When you look at us, what do you see? Do you see an animal with a glimmer of godliness? Or do you see a god with an animal body? That's the issue. And you just have to look around, and that's the first thing that one has to ask oneself when one's dealing with people, when one's seeing people. What do I see in front of me? Do I see an angel with a human body, or do I see an animal with a little bit of sophistication? And that depends on the way we behave. And if we behave like animals, if it's hard to differentiate us from the animal, and we argue against evolution, we're making a mockery of the argument. At the end of the day, the issue is not what happened millions of years ago. The issue is, who am I? Am I more of an ape than a human being, or am I more of a human being than an ape? The answer is, have a look and see. Watch yourself and see what you are. What are you motivated by? What are you driven by? What are you striving for? What are you willing to? What sacrifices are you willing to make? And then decide whether you descended from the ape or you descended from the human being. There's that lovely story of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky that they tell. It's so beautiful, and it was a true story, where he's sitting in an aeroplane arguing with this, I think it was a social anthropologist or somebody, some Israeli sitting next to him about evolution. And they're arguing, and it goes on. And as the flight goes on, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky's grandchildren keep on coming up to him and Zayda, do you have what you need? Can we bring you something to drink? Can they bring you something to eat? Are you warm enough? Are you this? And they keep on taking care of him. And as they're about to get to their destination, the anthropologist says to Rabbi Yaakov, I must compliment you and your grandchildren. My grandchildren, if they were sitting on the plane, they wouldn't come near me. They'd be embarrassed to come anywhere near me. They certainly wouldn't worry about me and take any interest in me. The way your grandchildren behave is unbelievable. So Rabbi Yaakov says, that's not surprising. You see, you teach your grandchildren that you descended from the ape. In that case, they are further from the ape than you are. You're closer to the ape, so why should they show you any respect? You're more of an animal than they are. You should be asking them if they're okay. You should be showing them honor. I teach my grandchildren that we're descended from the greatest man that ever lived, Adam, and that we came from Avraham and from Yitzchak and Yaakov. They're further away from that greatness than I am. I'm closer to that greatness than them, so they owe me that honor and dignity, and they understand that. So when you're teaching the question of evolution or non-evolution, determines the whole moral standards of declining generations. If you're teaching evolution, then there's no declining generation. If you're teaching evolution, every generation is more sophisticated. So there's no reason for a child to honor a parent. A parent should honor a child because the child is more sophisticated. And a grandparent should honor a grandchild. So together with teaching evolution, in the simple sense of evolution, you've got to also teach the glorification of the child as being the ultimate of humanity. If you're teaching the Torah system, and as I said last week, that the body evolved, that there's no question about. We see that clearly in Chazal. All we see is that wasn't the whole story, that together with the evolution of the body, there was the imposition of a godly spirit and soul on the human being, which created that human being, and that's the real true essence of the human being. But if you teach the Torah's view, then you're teaching the decline of man. That the greatest man who ever lived was Adam. He was the most sophisticated man that ever lived. Look how God put him together. And since then, we've been on a decline. In that case, we've got to honor our elders. We've got to honor people who are closer to that than we are. The greatest level of spiritual sophistication was in earlier generations, not in latter generations. Now, let's go back for a moment to Rashi's view that God discussed the whole thing with the angels. What did the angels answer when God said, let's create Adam? They started a major debate, says the Medrash. This wasn't a simple little thing where God just politely said, let's make Adam, and then he went along and made him. The angels went into uproar. There was total uproar up there. And they started lobbying. And they started dividing into different groups, the pro-life and the anti-life. The one group said, man should be created, this is a wonderful idea. And one group said, the old man's gone out of his mind. Creating a human being, that's the last thing we need around here. What was the basis of their argument? The four groups were the following. Chesed Oymer Yiboro. There was a group of angels that supported the principle of chesed, of human interaction, of supportiveness, of kindness, of empathy, sympathy. That whole group of angels said, let's create man. Because man will, that's exactly what man will do. Man has the capacity to empathize and to sympathize and to be supportive. The MS, but there's another group of angels, those that stand for uncompromised truth. Oymer al yibor, no human beings around here. Shekulo shkorim, men, human beings will never be honest, they'll never be true. There'll always be an element of deceitfulness, and we don't need human beings around here. So those were the two views. Tzedek, righteousness, oymer yibor. Tzedek said, let man be created. Shu'oy setzedokus, he'll do righteous deeds, he'll give charity, he'll be support poor people, a wonderful thing to create a human being. Shalom, but peace said, al yibore de kula ktoto. Peace said, man, well, there'll be arguments. If you create man, there's conflict, there's argument, there's war. It's not in our interest that there should be a human being. So you had all these groups. And it was two against two. Two said he should be created, and two said he shouldn't. Me'a also HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what did God do? Notal emes v'hishlichoy la'oretz. He took truth and threw him out. A very challenging medrash. Of all the four, God throws out, firstly, you see how democratic God is. God says, let us create man. What do you guys think? The angels discuss, and it's 50-50. So God says, well, that's no good. We've got to make a decision here, and it's got to be a majority decision. So, Emes, out. Let's take another vote. Now we've got a majority, we can create man. What did he do with Emes? He throws him to the ground. The whole Christian story of the fallen angel and all that kind of thing, here's its source. There was such a thing, there was an angel, and God did cast him out of heaven. But it wasn't Lucifer, it was Emes. It was the force of truth God threw out. Amru malachi asharis lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ribbono Yoreh, ma ata mevatel tachzei sal tichzei yeshelcha. Look what you've just thrown out. The most precious of all, truth you threw out. You've left kindness and you've left charity and you've left... truth you've thrown out. The most precious one of yours. Answers God, Taile emes min ha'oretz, let emes come up from the land. That's all the Medrash says, and the Medrash is more or less beyond understanding, except for the Ktzos HaChoshen, who says in his introduction. I've mentioned it to you in previous shiurim, but I'm going to do it inside with you because it's so basic to the way we function. I've made myself very unpopular recently by claiming that the return to religion is not a return to Judaism, and it's not a return to Torah, and it's not a return to truth, because it's a return to fundamentalism. People are feeling insecure, so they want black and white rules. And if you're Jewish, you become religious and you find your black and white rules. If you're a Muslim, you become religious and you find your black and white rules. If you're a Christian, you become religious and you find your black and white rules. And the Baal Tshuva movement is no greater among the Jews than it is among the Muslims and the Christians and all the other. It's a move towards this kind of very fundamental way of thinking. And that's not Torah. That's not Yiddishkeit. So that the move you see taking place is not a genuine, yes, it's very lovely that people want to reattach themselves to their Jewish roots and origins and sources and all that. There's something very beautiful about it. But we have to be careful before we think that this is a return to what the Torah is, because what the Torah provides when you become religious is not comfort. Unfortunately, the most comforting religion, if you want comfort, is Christianity. That's an extremely comfortable religion. If you're willing for a little bit of hardship, then Catholicism. But you've still got the comfort, you've still got the fallback. A little bit more hardship, Islam. If you want to become religious in a Torah sense, there's no comfort. There's a great deal of excitement and challenge. But there's no comfort because there are no black and white answers. And if you're searching for black and white answers, this is not the place to search. And unfortunately, there's a tremendous demand for black and white answers. Let's understand what this Medrash means. So he quotes the Medrash, and then he says, the Ktzos HaChoshen. He He says, "V'hainu mishum diyadua de seichel ha'odom yilo lehosik ha'emes bihi yosoi ba'oretz shorsho." We've just learnt that man is created of a synthesis of earth and spirituality, God and earth. So already there's no way that man, being made of that synthesis, could possibly grasp pure spiritual truth. It's not possible. There's already a built-in distortion, there's already a built-in thickness, a built-in materialism that makes it impossible for us to grasp pure spirituality. Just by the way we've understood what man is created from. Can't be. And that's why the angel said to God, "You are disgracing your most beautiful ornament." Your most beautiful ornament is truth. Kivan she'ikar ha'biriya avur ha'Torah. The main purpose of the creation is the Torah, in its widest sense of that, of the meaning of that word. The ha'odom besichloya enoshi me'animna lahasik ho'emes ha'amisi. And the human being, using his human intellect, cannot possibly understand the Torah objectively, accurately. It's not possible. God conceived of the Torah. God is completely spiritual. We are not. There's another part to us, and therefore there's no way we could understand the Torah with objective accuracy. And how does the system work? Man makes decisions. God gave man the right to make halachic decisions. So who's interpreting the Torah? We don't have a direct line to God. If we want to know, and that's why I said Torah doesn't offer comfort, if you're sitting out and trying to figure what this piece of Torah means, you can't send a fax to the Ribbono Shel Olam and say, "Just interpret, tell me, am I on the right tracks or am I wrong? And if so, tell me what's wrong." You can't. So we've got to interpret it ourselves. And we don't know the objective. We don't know it with objective accuracy. So you're actually compromising your essence, say the angels to God, because you are truth, and you are allowing man to interpret the Torah using the synthesis of earth and man, of animal and godly, synthesized into one. So little by little the Torah is going to be distorted in its interpretation. To this God answers, "Zeu ritzoni," but that's exactly what I want. "Shetale emes min oretz," I don't want the objective truth. I want the truth that man is able to grasp. I want the truth that man is able to evolve and develop and reason and think. That's what I've created him for. "V'ha emes yiyeh kifi haskomas hachachomim b'seichel ha'enoshi." The new truth will be how that human being that I've just created, this human being who has a godly link and an earthly link, that human being who straddles the whole spectrum of reality, from the earthiest of the earthy to the most spiritual of the spiritual, when he, with that vast spectrum of experience, interprets the essence of the Torah, that's the truth of the Torah from now on. Zuhi Birkas HaTorah. And what do we say when we're called up to the Torah? Asher Nosan Lonu Toras Emes. God has given the truth of the Torah to us. We can interpret the truth of the Torah. Shiyeh Ho Emes Itonu. The truth is with us. We decide what will be. And he goes on to develop the idea a little bit further. Of course, in deciding the Torah, God, as I discussed in the shul this afternoon at the Shabbos shul, God has given us methodology. He hasn't just left us to just make our own things up. He hasn't left it hefker. He hasn't left it chaotic. He's given us a Torah which is purely spiritual. He's created us who have this ability to synthesize the physical and the spiritual in one being. And he's given us the methodology of interpretation, which is the Gemara. The Gemara is the methodology of interpretation. How to take that essential Torah and interpret it in a way which is contextualized in the full span of our experience, from the earthy side to the spiritual side, to incorporate all of that and introduce all of that into our understanding of the Torah. That's what God gave us in the Gemara, and therefore, provided one is professionally schooled in the methodology of the Gemara, one is qualified to interpret, and that interpretation becomes the truth as far as God is concerned, even though it's not accurate. And you remember the famous story of the Chachomim arguing, and the majority say one, and there's a single authority who says the other way, and he brings all sorts of miraculous proofs that he's right. And the walls of the shul start caving in, and he says the walls of the shul should stand upright again, and the river flows backwards, and the tree uproots itself, and eventually a heavenly voice comes out and says, he's right. And the Chachomim turn around and say, you keep out of it, God. You gave us the Torah, we can interpret it. And we go by the majority of professional opinions, not by an individual view. So what does God say when God says he is right? Objectively, he's right. But the fact is, God says, I commit myself to following the way you develop an understanding of the Torah, the way you develop it, the way you reason it, the way you integrate it. That's what I commit myself to. And so we find Judaism as the only religion that doesn't revolve around objectively accurate truths. Its essence is objectively accurate truths, but that objectivity has to be synthesized with the subjectivity of a human being who has been able to sanctify himself, his reasoning, his experience, and able to apply that sanctified intellect, but a human intellect, not a godly intellect, to the interpretation of the Torah. That's what God wants. There's no other religion that does that at all, never mind with such beauty. And that's why in other religions you have a requirement that holy people disassociate themselves from the world, whether it's in Christianity or it's in the Eastern religions or even in Islam to some degree. But the more holy the person is, the more disassociated he is from the world. And we've never had that. We've always required an engagement in the world. Not an engagement that allows the human being to be pulled down to the level of the world, but an engagement that allows the human being to uplift the world with him, to uplift those people and those experiences that he's interacting with, to uplift that with him, not that he just goes up some kind of elevator and leaves the world behind him. Then he loses the capacity to interpret the Torah with the full spectrum of experience that God wanted in that very interpretation. And that's all that is implied in this. And God said, let us create Adam, leading to this full discussion among the angels, and the decision that God takes the angel of truth, throws him out to earth, and says, your place is down there now. You no longer belong up in heaven where we deal with objective absolutes. Your place is down there. I want you to come up from earth. I want truth to be developed from earth. I don't want truth to be imposed on earth. And so we find again in the Torah, as much as it is a top-down process, it's simultaneously a bottom-up process. And on the one hand, we're given the principles, we're given certain axioms that we can't play around with. There's certain things that we can't play around with. There's a God. God created the earth. God gave the Torah on Sinai. What the constitution of the Torah, we can't play around with that at all. The methodology was given on Sinai. We can't play around with the methodology. It can be handed down. Yes, and each generation has innovated, sophisticated methodology using the principles that were taught at Sinai, but it's all using the principles that were taught at Sinai. On that we can have no compromise, and on that we can have no adulteration. But once that's in place, the application, the accommodation of those Torah principles to contemporary life has to be achieved here at earth. And we build it up from earth, and we develop it and so to say, beam it to God, and God then deals with it as truth. Truth which we have developed and truth which we've perceived. And then, once man has reached this level, we can carry on with that verse. The yirdu bidgas hayom uva oif hashomayim uva behemo uva chol haoretz uva chol haremes haroimes al oretz. Man will rule over, man will master the birds of the heaven, the animals that roam on the earth, and the creepy crawly things that creep over the earth, and the fish of the sea. So man now becomes central and to the universe and master of the universe. Man is not just a part of the universe, just like you've got the animals and the plants, you've got the human being. The human being's role now is to master the animal world. To master the animal world outside of him and to master the animal world inside of him. Because now we have an interesting situation. We have an animal world out there. But that animal world is not just out there. That animal world penetrates right to the very essence of the human being. Animals are not just out at the Kruger National Park. Animals come right into me, myself. And the mastery of the animal requires the mastery of the world and all the animal forces in the world, including the wild animals out there, and the wild animal inside the human being. All of that needs to be mastered. And who's the being that's mastering it? Again, it's this being that we've described, this being that has been created with the capacity to straddle both extremes of the spectrum of existence, from the completely material to the completely spiritual. It's this great human being with this great capacity. He is designed to be able to master the world, to be able to master that animal world. And the word vayirdu is interesting. Those of you who've got Rashi will see. You'll notice in the word vayirdu, which means to master, you'll notice the root of the word is from raid, resh dalad, which means to be degenerate. The yirdu bidgas hayam, Rashi says, based on the medrash, yesh beloshon hazeh loshon ridui veloshon yirida. This word contains two implications. It implies ridui, which is mastery, and it implies yirida, which is degeneracy. Zocho roide b'chayus v'ahemus. If a person is worthy of it, he rules over the animals. Loi zocho naase yorud lifneihem v'achayo moshil esboi. If he is not worthy, then the animal rules him. And that's in two ways. But before we look at the two ways, the Medrash brings that slightly differently. If I can find it. Yes, the Medrash says the following. Es shehu betzalmenu kidmusenu urudu. When the human being is in our image, he will master the animal. Es she'enu betzalmenu kidmusenu yirdu. If he is not in our image, he will be degenerate before the animals. The animals will master him. The animals will be more sophisticated than him, will be superior to him. So we have a situation, as we have in many areas in the Torah, and we'll see as it progresses, this kind of polarity, where you don't have the option of creating an equilibrium between yourself and a particular object or range of objects. Either you're mastering or you are mastered. You don't have the opportunity to be one or the other. You have that kind of relationship with your children. You can't have a relationship of equilibrium. You're either in control or you are being controlled. And one has to be able to decide. You can't say, we have a nice relationship. We respect one another. It doesn't work that way. And it's the same way in an employment situation. If you're employing a workforce, you're either being controlled or you're in control. It's leadership. You're either in control or you are being controlled. It's a relationship with a television set. You either are controlling or you are being controlled. You can't have this kind of peaceful relationship. At any moment in a relationship, in almost any relationship, somebody is in control, somebody is being controlled. Of course, the person being controlled may choose to be controlled. So a student might go to study with a teacher and choose to be controlled by that teacher. But the fact that he's chosen to be controlled actually leaves him in control. He can walk out at any point, he can disagree at any point, he can challenge at any point. The moment he abandons that capacity, he is being controlled in total. And so it is in virtually all relationships. There is an ability to be in a situation of mastery. Perhaps mastery is a better word than control. Either you are mastering or you are being mastered. And it's important to know in what state one finds oneself. And the criterion, as far as the Medrash is concerned, is whether one is if one isn't, not just in God's image, now our present translation of B'Tzalmenu K'dmuseinu is the human being who incorporates the full spectrum of existence from the spiritual through to the material. If a person incorporates that full spectrum, he has the capacity to master the world. If he does not incorporate that full spectrum, it doesn't matter where on the spectrum if he is, if he's only spiritual or if he's only physical, and he doesn't incorporate the full spectrum, he loses the capacity to master the world. And in losing the capacity to master the world, he becomes mastered by the animal world, both by the animal inside himself and by the animal outside of himself. He becomes mastered. And that's why the Torah uses that word, which is an unusual word. It doesn't say v'yimshulu, you shall rule over, or v'chibshu, as it says later on, you shall dominate. It uses the word v'yirdu because it has that double meaning. Yirdu is a mastery dependent on your own stature. So the instruction here is, I'm creating man who has the capacity, if he chooses to maintain it, to master the world by his own stature. Not by being nasty, not by being cruel, not by being autocratic and arrogant, But v'yirdu means to master it by virtue of your own stature, that you have such a breadth to you. And here we're talking about breadth, that you have such a breadth to you that you're able to incorporate an understanding of the world that enables you to master it. It also leads us into an understanding of the fact that not all human beings are in the image of God. You often hear people saying, every human being is created in the image of God. That's true. Every human being has been created in the image of God, but he has the capacity to lose that image. One doesn't necessarily, because one was created in that image, one doesn't necessarily retain that image through one's entire existence. There are people who are no longer in the image of God. And thank God for that. Sometimes you see people and you say, my goodness, if that's the image of God, I would hate to see God. And that's valid, because there are people who are not created in the image of God. There are people who have lost their humanity. There are people who have lost their spirituality. There are people who have lost this breadth that we're talking about. There are people who have lost the spiritual depth that we're talking about. And they no longer are classified as being created in the image of God, and no longer have the rights, the same rights to being treated as one who is created in the image of God. They're still human beings, and they still have to be treated with the basic requirements of a human being. And that's part of the whole confusion, for example, now with the whole capital punishment debate. If you take religion out of the debate, then all men are equal, and who's one person to put to death another person? Who's one person to terminate the life of another person? And even if he's a vicious murderer who's killed thousands of people, who are we to put him to death? If you take God and religion out of the debate, then you're confused. There's no basis for it. But if you say when a person goes around murdering, he loses his godly image. And once he's lost his godly image, he doesn't have the same right to life that any other human being has. He has chosen to forego that right to life. And society then has an obligation to act accordingly. Let us go a little bit further. In verse 27, "Vayivro Elokim eso adam betzalmo, betzelem Elokim bara eso," and God created man in His image. Here we've got God's image, but in the image of God He created him. "Zochor unekeva bara eisom," He created them, male and female. Now there's an obvious grammatical inconsistency in this verse. He created him, it says. Male and female, He created them. How many did He create? Did He create two or did He create one? Did He create a male Adam and then later on put her to sleep and took out his rib and made a female from him, made Chava? Or were they both created at the beginning? Rashi says, those of you who've got it, Zachar nekeva bara eisom. But further on, the Torah tells us Vayikach achas mitzaloisov, that He takes one of the ribs of Adam and forms it into a woman. Medrash Hagodah, the Medrash teaches, Shebero'o shnei patzufim bivriya rishoyno v'achar kach chilko. Man was originally created male and female in one being. There were two parts to the human being. He had masculinity and femininity. So the woman was not an afterthought. She was not created later on. She was created right up at the beginning, equal to man. There was absolute equality between male and female. And later on, the story thereafter is the separation of male and female into two separate human beings who could interact. But the first stage and the first phase was the human being had masculinity and femininity incorporated in one personality. Vayavorech esom Elokim, and Hashem blessed them. Vayom Elohim Elokim, and Hashem said to them, Pru uravu umilu es haoretz v'kifshuha. Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth, and master it, conquer it. Here we've got v'kifshuha, a different word being used here. Uradu, back to that first word, uradu, and master bidgas hayom v'oif hashamayim v'chol haromeses al haoretz. Master the fish in the sea, the birds of the heaven, and all the animals and creepy things that roam across the earth. Now, there's a Rashi that I've got to do with you, although it's not a very popular one among some people. And he comments on the grammar of that word, v'chivshuha. V'chivshuha means, and conquer it, meaning conquer the earth. But the way it's written is without the Vav. It's written as V'kivsho, which means conquer her. And if you look at the Rashi on Posuk Kafches, Chaser Vav, says Rashi, there's a Vav missing. L'lamedecho shehazochor kovesh es hanekevo sheloi tehe yatzonis. Now the whole thing with women's lid and so on, one has to be careful that one doesn't move away from an authentic interpretation of the Torah. And the fact that certain views and certain philosophies become popular at different times of human existence doesn't mean that there's going to be any kind of a change in the interpretation of the Torah. The way we apply the Torah, the way we utilize the Torah, the way we adapt the Torah and accommodate contemporary life, that's where the flexibility has to come in. But in the understanding of the principles of how man was created, what was the essence of it? And Rashi says here that the kivsho, based also on the medrash for kivsho and conquer her, is to teach shehazocher kovesh es hanekevo sheloitehe yatzonis. Let's translate that accurately. That the male conquers the female so that she should not be a yatzonis. Yatzonis is a very relationship. So as much as it doesn't sound sort of very fair and equal, the fact is that's how life is lived. That's when the relationship is sound. Shalotahe yatzonis means when she does not have to go out and do the conquering. That's what shalotahe yatzonis means. So what does she need to do? She needs to be able to attract the kind of person that she would like to conquer her. And we've discussed this before. What happens when finally, so she's now identified, there's Mr. Perfect. And if only this guy would take an interest in her, that would be fantastic. And she starts working. And how does she work? Not by being a yatzonis, not by being outward. She works by being attractive. And all of a sudden, he takes notice of her one evening at a party. And now she sees something's beginning happening. And finally, the telephone rings on Wednesday and says, I met you at the party, you might remember. Are you doing anything this Saturday night? What does she say? This Saturday night, of course. I'm going to the shir, and after the shir, I'm going out. And he says, oh, Don, what about next Motzei Shabbos? She says, next Motzei Shabbos, I'm also busy. And meanwhile, she's hoping, I hope to goodness, he says once more, and what about the next one? He says, and the next one? She says, the next one, let me check in my diary. Yeah, I'm free. The next one, I'm free. I'm okay. And they make an arrangement. And then he says, phew, and she says, phew. And everybody says, what are the games? What's it all about? Why doesn't she just say, of course I'm free this Saturday night. Nobody's asked me out for weeks. Why doesn't she just tell the truth? Why doesn't she say, the moment I saw you at the party, I was hoping you would phone me. And I've kept my phone free. I've been sitting at the phone in case you phone me. Why doesn't she say that? That's not the way she wants it, and that's not the way he wants it. There needs to be that kind of feeling. So yes, it can be, one can play a game, and then as soon as the game is over, of course, the relationship collapses. And one wonders why so many relationships collapse, because they start out as games. People know the dynamics, and they use the dynamics to be able to bring about. They manipulate the dynamics. And she makes him think that he's conquering, and he makes her think that he's conquering, and at the end of the day he finds out that she was doing the conquering, and she finds out that he's a shlemiel that anybody could have conquered, and the whole relationship falls to pieces. Whereas in truth what it needs to be is that's the true dynamic that needs to be. Really, what the ideal is, when she is so popular that she is busy every Motzei Shabbos, and Kay, and she feels secure and she feels comfortable, and then he carries on that way for the rest of their relationship, and he remains that admirable person, and he remains that person who is strong, not strong because she is weak, strong even though she is strong. It makes no difference. He has his own internal strengths which she respects, and that you'll find. What does a woman respect in a man? Is strength. So in a very physical person, it might be pure physical strength. In a more intelligent person, it might be intellectual strength, spiritual strength, there are all sorts of strengths. But at the end of the day, a woman wants a strength in a man. Because, lamedecho shehazocho kovesh esanakevo. At the end of the day, as strong as the woman is, and bear in mind again, they're created together. They're created as one being with equal strength. But the dynamic is that in some area of life that is valuable to her, he is able to dominate her. Dominate her again, just as we said in the case of Radu, not to dominate with cruelty, not to dominate with brute strength, not to dominate with deceit, but to dominate with breadth, to dominate with vision, to dominate with depth, to dominate with spirituality, with sensitivity. That's the kind of kipshua that she requires. So there's an implication that when God says to man, be fruitful and multiply, he's instructing mankind to engage in sexual relationships, and in that he's already giving the key to the game. The key is that a man has to develop his personality sufficiently to be strong enough in the areas that are important to the woman he wants to attract, to be able to master her, to be able to lead her in that particular area, that she doesn't feel insecure and without leadership in that particular area. She has an equally important role, but not in this specific area. The further consequence of that is, if you go on in the second part of the Rashi, is v'oid l'lamedecho, to teach you further, sheho ish shedarkoi lichbosh mutzuve al piriyo verivya v'loi ho'isho. Therefore, since he's the one who goes out conquering, the mitzvah of getting married and having children, the obligation, the responsibility is his. Because now she could say, well then I'm not in control. If that's the game, and I'm using game in inverted commas, then I can't really be in control. Who knows who I'm going to find, or who is going to find me, or whether anybody is going to find me. And God acknowledges that. And so since you're not the pursuer, you're not to do it, and rather don't become the pursuer, because that compromises you. God doesn't say, yes, you're obligated to get married. Women are not obligated to get married. Men are obligated to get married. There is not an obligation on a woman to get married. And that's why the man gives the woman the ring. The man marries the woman. The whole thing is an action on the part of the man. The woman is not obligated. And if women would understand that they're not obligated to get married, they would be a much more relaxed in their role of being one of attraction rather than one of pursuit. And they would feel far more comfortable about it. Yes, the man has to find a wife and he has to get married and have children. Consequently, of course, women are part of that and equal partners of that. But they don't have the obligation. That removes the pressure from them. And that, although emotionally there's an enormous pressure, emotionally a woman wants to settle down, wants to get married, wants to have children, but she doesn't have that chiyuv, she doesn't have that obligation. She's got to go, she's got to do the thing the way she's meant to do it, and the Ribbono Shel Olam guides things in such a way that the right person finds her at the right time, and then she's able to do it without compromising her essence. Because if she were obligated, she would have to go out on pursuit. And if a woman goes out in pursuit, she loses her femininity. And that God never wanted. For a woman to lose her femininity. The things we've touched on this evening have been so critical that what I'm going to do is for 5 minutes I'm going to take questions. If there's anything specific on these areas, I want to avoid misunderstanding and have the opportunity. And we might, in fact, before the next year, also spend 5 minutes at the beginning. Just taking questions on Toby. There are two different things that you're touching on. Did you turn it off? You're finished the recording.